This is your station, 88.9 KETR. Scott Harvey in studio with Savannah Christian, the East Texan, and we're joined by noted journalist and world-renowned speaker Dan Rather. Mr. Rather, it's a pleasure to have you in studio with us today.
It's a pleasure to be back in Commerce and on campus. Thank you.
You'll serve as the guest speaker in the prestigious speaker series at Texas A&M University Commerce tonight at 7:30 from the Ferguson Auditorium. The event entitled Hard Times Then and Now, which addresses our challenging economy from your perspective as a child of the Great Depression. You're a native of Texas, a graduate of Sam Houston State University, and as I understand it, do you still own a home in Austin?
I do. The nature of my work is my principal home is in New York and has been for a long time. But my daughter and one of my grandsons live in Austin, and we have a small place in Austin and get to it as often as we can, especially during bluebonnet time.
When you think about some of the earliest journalism experiences you had in Texas, what are some of the fondest memories?
Well, I have so many fond memories. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that I was born here, and I never saw any place outside of Texas until I was in my very late teens, maybe early 20s. But, you know, I'm one of those lucky people. I always aspired to be a journalist. Why, I've never quite known. I've tried to write about it in a book I have coming out called Rather Unspoken. But I think it's because my parents were avid newspaper readers. But at any rate, I hung around newspapers in Houston. I was born in Wharton, Texas, but I grew up on the outskirts of Houston, went to Houston Public Schools. And some of my fond memories were when I actually first got to a newsroom. We had three daily newspapers in Houston at that time, the Houston Chronicle, Houston Post, and Houston Press. And, you know, I hung around, ran coffee, and tried to listen to these whiskey-breathed, nicotine-stained, stubble-bearded, old-time newspaper people and just dreamed of being one of them at one time. But that was a fond memory. And I could tell you when I worked, I wasn't paid, but when I hung around the Chronicle, but I could tell you everybody's name in the newsroom and how they took their coffee. Two sugars, one cream, no cream, so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's a fond memory. When I first got paid as a journalist, which was pretty early on, maybe I was 17, wasn't paid much, but it was stringing for AP and UP. When I first actually saw a check, having worked as a reporter, that's a very fond memory. I've worked in the pipeline gangs and oil fields during the summers most of the time. But when I got that first check, that was a memory to savor, believe me.
Mm-hmm. With the large scope of impactful stories you've had a chance to cover in your years in the journalism industry, which ones do you find yourself kind of reflecting on the most and comparing to our current state?
Well, keep in mind that I've been mightily blessed and very lucky to have covered my share, maybe more than my share, of, quote, big stories. That if you had told me when I was coming up that I was going to get one of those stories to cover in a lifetime, the covering Dr. Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, Watergate, if you had told me I'd get any one of those stories when I was coming up, I'd say, thank you, Lord, and be on my knees thanksgiving. But I do want to answer your question, that when I reflect, you know, I'm still working full-time, so I don't have a lot of time to stand up in the stirrups and look back over trails that I have traveled. I'm looking ahead to the next story. But certainly the experience of covering Dr. Martin Luther King and the early civil rights movement, which was 1962 going into 1963, changed me as a person and as a pro. That having said, I grew up in Texas. Sad to say, Texas had institutionalized racism the whole time that I was coming up. I went to segregated schools. Everybody did. Institutions were segregated. But Texas was not Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, or South Carolina. And covering Dr. King, when I think back over stories I've covered, made as large, perhaps a larger imprint on me as both a person and a professional than anything I've covered. The four dark days in Dallas with the assassination of President Kennedy, and then incredibly, the assassination of his assassin, it still sort of catches in your throat when you think back on it. That for a breaking news story over a reasonably short period of time, of course it resonated for a long time, was a hammer to the heart and an unforgettable time.
Those are very intense moments. You say Martin Luther King, Civil Rights Movement, the JFK assassination, your coverage of Vietnam from the ground. What's it like to be a journalist in that moment?
Well, if you long dreamed and hoped of being a journalist and aspired to be, yes, a world-class journalist, I'm not saying that I ever have been or am now, but in the moment, that's where you want to be. And I don't mean this in any self-serving way, whatever, but in the moment, what little time one has to think, I found myself thinking, you know, this was my destiny. This is what I dreamed of doing. This is what I hope to do. And, well, I'm actually doing it. And it's a cliche, but sometimes I found myself really literally wanting to pinch myself to say, am I really here? Am I really doing this? The other is the sense of responsibility. And I don't want to overdo this, but you know, one of the great things about being in journalism, if you have a passion to do it, is the belief, rightly or wrongly, that you're doing something that counts, that news matters. Journalism, when it's done right, does matter. And so you have a sense of responsibility, a sense of duty, if you will. I know some people outside of journalism, maybe a lot inside journalism, that may sound a little highfalutin, but that's genuinely how I felt, that it's a mission, and you feel lucky and blessed to be there. You want to do the best you can do. You know, every journalist worthy of the name prays, God, give me the big story. Now, being greedy, you always pray right behind that, oh, and by the way, God, if you do give me the big story, please let me be at or near my best on it.
Your address tonight will focus on the economy from the Great Depression to the current recession. Could you provide us with some talking points?
Well, this subject, frankly, the university came up with the subject.
Okay.
And I'm happy to talk about it in this sense because I think it's relevant to today. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, we have an economy which seems to be improving now, but is still fragile here in the second decade of the 21st century. We've gone through a very deep recession, which skidded right on the edge of being another Great Depression. So as one who lived through the Great Depression and was of memory age for part of the Great Depression, I have some very vivid memories of those and lessons to be drawn that in our neighborhood, the Houston Heights, I wouldn't say it was harder hit than any place else, but it was very hard hit, that in a 16-square-block neighborhood, my father was the only person who had a job even some of the time. Now, I don't say that to play some humble beginnings. There were people in our neighborhood who were a whole lot worse off than we were. But a lot of the talk was about finding work, getting a job. Well, how often do you hear now, either on campus or off campus, you know, where can I get a job? How am I going to get to work? This is a tough job market. Well, that was the toughest job market of the 20th century and one of the toughest job markets in the whole history of the country. So what I hope to do is mix some historical references, some literary references, with some personal anecdotes of the time in hopes of, particularly with students, I recognize the audience will be more than students for the talk, to say, okay, hard times, these times, what lessons can we draw from the hard times of the past? You know, sometimes it's hard times, sometimes it's good times, and a lot of the time it's a hard-to-tell times.
Mm-hmm.
But with today's economy, I think it's foremost in people's mind now. Where are we really with the economy as opposed to where we hope we might be and where may we be headed? I'm not a predictor of anything. I'd like to think on my best days, maybe on my best days, I'm a pretty good reporter about what has happened. But I learned a long time ago when it comes to predictions that he who lives by the crystal ball learns to eat a lot of broken glass. And I've eaten my share over the years. But I do want to talk about how, you know, our history beginning for purposes of this talk with the Great Depression, which really didn't finally end until the fury of World War II. And coming out of World War II, America boomed. We had a great boom period beginning with the end of the war, which stretched for most of the rest of the 20th century, but we did have recessions and downturns. And what did our grandparents and great-grandparents, in some cases parents, learn from that period that can be put to good use today by students and even mature adults? What do we learn from it? And what may it tell us about what's coming ahead? Those are among the points I want to talk about when it comes to the economy. Probably talk a little bit about how, in my opinion, and my opinion is often wrong, that jobs and the economy will decide this presidential election in 2012. There's a lot of tumult and shouting about other issues, I wouldn't say side issues, that will capture the moment in any given moment, whether it's Republican debates or something President Obama said. But when we get around to November, my experience in covering politics is most people vote their pocketbooks, and people's assessment of where we are economically and where we may be headed is likely to be decisive. So I may talk some about that.
Okay. And that'll be at 7:30 in the Ferguson Auditorium here on campus. We've seen a lot of breakthroughs in technology, the demand for news and information. What are your thoughts on how it's impacted journalism?
Well, we could talk the rest of the afternoon, but I'll try to keep it short. That we've moved well into the Internet age, that I'm old enough, I was born in 1931, to have seen, not just in terms of the United States, our beloved United States of America, but in terms of the world, move from the newspaper era to the radio era to the television era, and now we've moved into the Internet era. If it isn't true already, and I believe it to be true, it will soon be true that the Internet will be the dominant place for people to get news. That doesn't mean that it's going to completely erase television, radio, and newspapers. But it's the future, and in many ways the future is now. Now, your question is how that has impacted journalism. Mm-hmm. Not just because of the Internet. There have been a lot of other factors that I think American journalism is and has been for some little while now in crisis. In some ways, those of us in journalism, and I do not accept myself from this criticism, we lost our grit and our guts. We lost the sense of what American journalism at its very best is supposed to be, which is a check and balance on power. That's the reason we have the First Amendment. Somehow we strayed away from that. And I've said, not everybody has always liked it, that we need a spine transplant, mm-hmm. that we just have somehow lost our backbone of speaking truth to power, being a little bit afraid to ask the tough question and the tough follow-up question, to be somewhat in awe, somewhat intimidated by power, whether it be political power, corporate power, union power, whatever. So I think that's put us in crisis. And without question, the standards of American journalism have diminished somewhat over the last 15 or 20 years. There's been what I call the corporatization, the politicalization, and the trivialization of the news. This has resulted in a lowering of standards almost across the board. There are a few exceptions. And that's important. It's important not just to journalists. It's important to every American. It's important to the country. Because let's see clearly what journalism as it's supposed to be is. Journalism is the red beating heart of freedom and democracy. The founders of the country realized then we haven't always operated with that foremost in our minds, but that's true. So when I talk about the diminishment of standards and the trivialization of news, the corporatization, the politicalization, which has led to this lowering of standards, that matters to everybody. I think that's where we are. I do see some glimmers of things getting somewhat better, that I think the experience of the Iraq War and what journalism and journalists, including this one, did and did not do in questioning the roll-up to the Iraq War, made a lot of journalists, including this one, think twice about what we should be doing, what we ought to be doing. I want to make clear that in saying that, I'm not stating a preference of whether we should have gone to war in Iraq or not have gone to war in Iraq, but what we know, and those of us in journalism knew it at the time, and I think a lot of Americans knew it, that the intelligence on which going to war was based, the rationale which we were given for going to war, was faulty. At the very minimum, it wasn't questioned as it should have been, and that's where journalists, mm-hmm. including this one, should have taken the lead, and in too many instances, we didn't.
I think you made these journalism comments before. One that comes to mind was a 2006 presentation in Seattle at McCaw Hill. I think you also mentioned there the consumers need to be smarter consumers of the news. Would you say that still rings true?
Well, I think it's truer today than it was when I said it then. It is very true. Don't misunderstand me. My experience is that the audience is a lot smarter than most people in radio, television, and newspapers believe them to be. But now more than ever, you do need to be a smart consumer of news, and this is why. There's so much over the airwaves, in print, on the computer, that passes for news, that poses as news, that is, quote, news, unquote, but is really entertainment. Mm-hmm. And the line between entertainment and news has been so blurred. Entertainment values have virtually overwhelmed news values that someone said, well, I saw in the news last night something. And when you question, it wasn't a newscast at all. It really was an entertainment program posing as a news program. For example, to get four people in a room shouting at one another about their opinions is something. It's certainly entertainment. You may get some information out of it, but it's not news. News is sending people to battleground in Afghanistan and Iraq. News is people grabbing a notepad or their computer and getting out of the office to go and talking to people about how deeply the economic downturn has cut. That's news. And by the way, one of my own definitions of news, I wish it were original with me, but it isn't, is that, you know, what people need to know, what's important for people to know, that somebody somewhere, especially somebody in power, doesn't want them to know, that is news. Almost everything else is publicity and propaganda.
Well, with that in mind, what is your thoughts on the current state of the 24/7 news stream and, more importantly, broadcast network nightly news? Where do you see it going?
I wish I could be more optimistic about the evening news, the news that comes at 5:30, 6, or 6:30 in the evening. In many ways, I think it's a dying business. I'll be surprised if the three so-called major networks continue, all three of them continue to do it for very much longer. I hope I'm wrong about that. There are a lot of reasons for it, the fracturing of the audience, the immensely enlarged size of the competitive pit, the internet, all of those things that go into it. I do believe, because partly it's been my experience and because I get out and talk to people, I think there's a real hunger among a large audience, not everybody, for real news, what I call real hard news. People want to know what's going on. You can find it now. You can find it on the internet. You can find it on your television set. You certainly can find it in newspapers and magazines. But you have to look harder today to find it than ever before. Because in New York now, I believe I get something like 800 channels, satellite and cable channels, on my television set. And stunningly, night after night, there's very little worth watching on it. Now, if you are careful and you're selective and you take the time, you can find places where there is real hard news. But that's why we need an educated and alert consumer. And I just, you know, softly and gently, I'm not preaching anything here, that the first question to ask when you tune in to a, quote, news program is this news or is this entertainment? And is the purpose a public service to provide information for citizens on which to make decisions, or is its sole purpose to get ratings, get better demographics, and make a profit for someone.
Of those programs that are real hard news, who are the journalists today that you admire?
Well, it's a good question, and I hope for the only time here I'm going to duck.
Gotcha.
and the reason is that if you start making a list, one is certain to bring leave somebody out. So I prefer not to do that. I will say that the Associated Press, which has been a bulwark of real hard news for well over 100 years, continues to be a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned. As you know, it's a cooperative of news organizations, the Associated Press serves. But the Associated Press, and one of the things I do admire about them, they cover breaking news, they cover state legislatures, which are increasingly undercovered, vastly undercovered. They cover local news, they cover international news, but they also do deep digging investigative reporting, which has shrunk ghastly over the last 10, 15 years. Not enough of it. And the AP continues to do that.
Dan Rather is speaking at Ferguson Auditorium on the campus of Texas A&M University Commerce tonight at 7:30. He joins us in studio now. Let's talk about your new memoir, Rather Outspoken. Excuse me. It releases, is it May 1st?
May 1st.
Okay.
Thank you.
What are some of the things that may surprise some of the readers?
You know, when you talk about your own work, and I do appreciate you mentioning the book, it's very hard to judge what will surprise people. Okay. But if anyone's still interested, and I would understand if they aren't interested, about how news, big time, big corporate international conglomerate news, works these days, how it really works, as opposed to how someone would have you believe it works, I think they may be somewhat surprised about how a story, for example, the terrible abuses in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. We broke that story at CBS News. We finally got it on the air. But how one of these large international conglomerate news organizations handles that kind of story, I think for someone who hasn't worked in news, and perhaps some who do work in news, may be surprised of what goes on behind the scenes. I would say the same thing about however one feels about it, President Bush's service or lack of military service during the Vietnam War. We did that story as well. It turned into controversy. We got in trouble over it. Maybe we should have been in trouble over it. I don't think so, but I understand those who do. But my point is, you said, what would surprise people? I think it might be an eye-opener of what was happening behind the scenes with that story. But I want to emphasize that the book is not mainly about those two stories, certainly not mainly about the Bush story. Mm-hmm. It's there, my version of what happened, how it happened, why it happened, and why you should care about why it happened is in the book. But I believe that I'm a pretty good storyteller. And with time to reflect, I think people may be surprised about what was happening during the Civil Rights Movement in the early days, how that was covered, what wasn't covered, why it wasn't covered. Watergate, the Watergate period, maybe some surprises. I look back on that, only president in the history of the country to be forced to resign and resign as, quote, an unindicted co-conspirator in a widespread criminal conspiracy. It still sort of knocks me back to think that happened. But I go through the sweep of what passes for my career with now more context and perspective on it than I've had before. But I also talk about the so-called new journalism or new era in journalism that I'm still working full-time. And thanks be to God and a lot of luck that I'm working for HDNet now, and we do hard-edged investigative reporting. And after I left CBS News, after 44 years there, the story of, well, how do you get into something new, particularly when you're already into your 70s, people may find some surprises with that. I at least think they find a good story. But I do appreciate you asking about the book. Mm-hmm. But if somebody says, in essence, what's the book about? I'd say, well, the book is about good stories well told, I hope.
It sounds like a lot of the book speaks to aspiring journalists.
Well, that's true. You know, I think a general readership will find a lot of interest in it. Self-serving statement, but I believe it has the added advantage of being true. But certainly, if there is an aspiring journalist or one has an aspiring journalist in the family, yeah, there'll be a lot in it that they can learn. Some of it may turn them in the direction away from journalism once they find out how it really works. But the answer to that is yes, of course, it is stuff in it for young journalists.
You mentioned your show, Dan Rather Reports, on HDNet. I noticed one of the blogs on there, how you discovered Facebook. And I'm curious, how have things like Facebook and Twitter changed the way you consume news? Or has it played a factor at all?
Well, as I think is the case with a lot of people, I'm keeping in mind that, you know, we have people in this country who can't afford a computer. We have people who've never had a computer in their home or school or with them. But with people who are computer literate, that Facebook, Twitter, the so-called social media, has changed the way consumers, not only how they get news, but how they view news that they get in other places. And that's been the case with myself, as you alluded to. I was slow to come around to social media. I cover stories. I don't have time to be tweeting people five times an hour. Besides that, I don't think anybody's interested where I got my hamburger today at lunch or some other important news bulletin. But I say that only half jokingly, because I have found that it's another venue, it's another pipeline, if you will, to people who are interested in news. And now I spend as little time as possible on it, but I do take certain periods of the day to file for Facebook, somewhat less for Twitter, but also on Twitter, because I've become a believer. It's one of the things I intend to talk about tonight, that in this era, the two most important things in any kind of communication, but particularly for news, number one is authenticity, to be authentic. And people have found on Facebook, for example, they can tell in an instant whether the person whose name is on it actually wrote it or whether some agent or publicity hound or something wrote it. So you have to be authentic. And the second is to carry on a conversation. You have to have a conversation with your audience or with your readership. If you're not authentic and you're not carrying on a conversation, then you're not likely to be relevant.
Dan Rather, it was a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for coming by.
Well, thank you so much for having me.